Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening. We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Popcorn Talk Network. Today, we are dissecting the fun 2015 summer movie from Adam Sandler, Pixels. Very exciting. Dimitri, you already got a laugh out of that theme song.
Oh, absolutely. Hello, movie fans. I was debating whether I should do this whole thing as Adam Sandler's Toll Booth Willie.
That would have been a different slant,
but yeah, I love this. This is a great way to get into a show, right?
We open up with Donkey Kong.
Of course.
Yeah, it was very fitting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marissa Serafini. Joining me, I have
Dimitri Panos. Hello, movie fans.
And we also have Phil Svitek in the booth. Say what's up, Phil.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is me. I am now Pac-Man.
Great.
Pac-Man takes on many different forms, apparently.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, not just ghost form.
There are no ghosts in the booth.
No. Just Pac-Man. That's very awesome. Okay, I was very excited for this movie. It looked awesome watching it. What were your quick overall thoughts, Dimitri?
Well, my quick overall thoughts in this film is that it is fun summer fare that is better. This is important. Better than critical response would have you believe. I think this movie is filled with awesome arcade nostalgia, silly non-offensive humor, and it made me wonder if there is this Adam Sandler hate that's permeated out there, and I have to believe, and I do believe, that this is that it's seeped through in all of the reviews. I think people went in bearing this hate that they felt that they needed to get this unwarranted anger out towards Adam Sandler.
I know.
And I think it affected everybody's reviews. This movie, I can name at least three movies that I was more entertained by Pixels than I was other three movies that came out this year and or summer. And I don't know. It's just, again, it's another one of those movies where I don't know what the critics were. I think they had their heads up their butts this time.
I think it's more so this film is you love it or you hate it. And I really haven't heard from other people who have seen this movie if they were mixed about it. It's love or hate. And I personally love this movie. I found it very enjoyable. Phil, what were your thoughts?
My thoughts, I really enjoyed this movie, and I went to see it with Marissa and another staff member here at Popcorn Talk, and, you know, it's a movie that I was looking forward to for a long time. It's a movie that, if you see the trailer, if you read just even a log line, a little blurb, you know what you're getting into. It's, you're fighting aliens using 80s video, arcade games. You know it's going to be fun and silly. And the fact that they stood by that and were able to do it well, I really commend them. It was phenomenal, and I just think it is unwarranted. I want to be a huge advocate for this movie so people do see it. I think people deserve to see it. I think, you know, not for the sake of the movie, but for the sake of themselves. They're doing themselves a disservice. If they like comedy, they should see this. And that's my stance.
Yeah, and that's a great stance, Phil. And I got to say that, you know, you were bringing up, like, you brought up, like, some really solid points that this, number one, this movie, not part of a quote unquote franchise, which I want to talk, we'll talk later on about what Chris Columbus thinks about franchise. Mm-hmm. And, but this is a relatively original idea. Granted, it was based off of a French short film,
from Patrick Jeanne,
right? And
also called Pixels.
And yet, it's still for theatrical release. This isn't based on any like other previous, not out of a comic book or anything like that. This is an original story. And this summer, you know, we have it. It's either been a sequel or something that's part of a bigger thing. Not mm-hmm. that that's bad, but I'm just saying I wanted to celebrate everything that Phil said and you were saying. But the fact that, you know, we got original entertaining fare. You know, is this movie great? No, but why does every movie have to be great, folks? You can just walk out of a movie with a smile on your face and be happy.
Right. And this is, and we talk about it all the time, this is a fun summer popcorn movie.
Absolutely.
Hello, Popcorn Talk.
Hello, Popcorn Talk. But, you know, I was thinking my drive in here today, like, this movie could have been released on December 25th. I mean, when do kids get a ton of video games, right? On Christmas. Like, this would have been a, this would have played well at Christmas time, too. You know,
they had big contenders to go up against, but
they had big contenders to go up against, you know, in the summertime. So yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I had a really good time.
Yeah, I enjoyed this movie. I personally am not the biggest gamer. I mean, growing up, I played a few games here and there, probably just a handful, but games were not my thing. And so watching this film, it was fun to see all the big past famous arcade games that everyone from the 80s, 70s grew up loving. And I feel that was definitely geared toward that demographic who came to watch this movie. Yeah. And who, if you love the games, I'm sure this movie did a great honor to show like how fun these games were.
Right. And you know, Adam Sandler always has a foot in the past, particularly the 80s, when you look at a lot of his movies. And this movie, you know, was great. The Easter eggs of video games that they threw in there, outside of the big ones that are really heavily showcased, like a Pac-Man and Donkey Kong. But, mm-hmm. you know, for me to see the Paperboy kid, like, riding out in his bicycle and stuff, and seeing things like Frogger and Defender, I yep. mean, that was awesome. I grew up going to arcades. That was part of the fun. The opening of the movie, when he and his friend go to, it's 1982, I believe.
82, yeah.
And they ride their bikes to the brand new arcade that just opened up. And as soon as they walked in, I had a smile on my face because it was almost like arcades have a particular smell. It's like walking into a Toys R Us. Like there's a certain odor, and arcades have that electric xenon, like, oil. Smell and like kids playing games. And I remember lining up, putting my quarter in the glass, saying, this is my cue, that's my quarter, this is when I'm up next. And I was in the movie right there. Right.
Felt like a kid again.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, he captured it. And it was all the Cheap Trick surrender. That was great.
Now, Phil, I know you play a lot of games nowadays, but were you a big arcade type of gamer when you were younger?
Let's get one thing straight. Do I play a lot of video games? I play like Madden 2015 once on every Super Bowl, and I'll play a wrestling game at like WrestleMania. I've so by no means am I a quote-unquote gamer.
You play more games than I do. Let's clarify that. He plays more games than I do, and I never play games. So
fair enough. But you know, I mean, one of the things I can relate a little bit to Adam Sandler's character for the sole reason that, you know, while I love today's video games for their storyline, their graphics and things like that, the new Batman one in particular is amazing. I love those. But it just the controls are just so complicated and so on and so forth that, you know, in many ways I feel like I can't play this. It's just too complicated. And so his thing was, you know, that there was always a pattern, and that was ultimately more or less his arc. I don't know how well he actually ultimately ended up arcing in the sense of that, you know, he couldn't just follow patterns and he had to, you know, kind of be sporadic in his own right. But it was fun to see. I really loved the concept. And in terms of getting in there, I thought the little prologue set it up nicely so people, you know, of this generation understood these video games, because it is tough, you know, when you talk to gamers today, I'm sure they're like, I'm sure everyone's kind of heard of Pac-Man, but have they ever played Pac-Man and these various other things? No, but they explain the rules fairly easy, and the nice part is that the rules themselves are easy, unlike, let's say, today's video games.
Oh, no, yeah, I agree with you 100%, and I think, though, there is this nostalgia that permeates through, I think, today's social media and websites. I mean, it seems to be a very big thing today. If you go on various, like various movie websites, in fact, where they will redo a trailer in 8-megabyte type Pac-Man graphics, like those old 80s arcade game type of graphics. So there is this throwback out there. When you look at Pac-Man and its cultural importance to video gaming, I mean, you know, prior to it, there was like a Space Invaders and you know, you can go back to Pong, and then Atari hits. But once Pac-Man came out, like it took America by storm. I mean, there was a Saturday morning cartoon, mm-hmm. Pac-Man cartoon for kids to watch. So, you know, it was good times. And Adam Sandler and Chris Columbus. I gotta throw Chris Columbus out there because this is as much his movie. This is an era.
This is totally his movie.
He grew up in. He wrote movies about. Okay, so he knows what he's playing with in this sandbox, and there was much passion for that, and I think they really did it right, and it was a lot of, and that's what made this movie fun.
Yeah, and speaking of Chris Columbus and how he got on board, apparently Pixels, this movie, because yes, it was adapted from the short film back from 2010, I believe. Actually,
right. It was a two-year process.
Two-year process, yep. That took like $5,000 budget from Patrick John, but from that, they created the script for Pixels,
right?
But it went through so many different rewrites, and they brought in Chris Columbus,
right,
because he's known for rewriting
and let me
scripts and breaking it down, right, in a director's standpoint.
And I misinformed you. It wasn't referencing Patrick John's process for that. It took him 2 years,
yeah,
but developing the script for some time before even Chris Columbus got involved, it was like a 2-year process. Which, you know, but getting Chris Columbus involved gives you credence. I think it sets something that you know you're going to get. I mean, Chris Columbus has worked with some of the greats, and bringing him on board, you know, to direct an Adam Sandler movie, I think was a stroke of genius, because if anybody understood the 80s as much as, say, Adam Sandler did, mm-hmm. it would be Chris Columbus. And I think that bringing him on board really legitimates the nostalgia-ness of this, of Pixels. And I think he did a great job directing this movie.
Absolutely. And then also, you know, writing and being very much involved with the script writing was Tim Herlihy. Who's Adam Sandler's,
right,
really good friend and co-writer, and he's worked with Adam for
years, forever.
Like they're two peas in a pod. And excuse me, he himself is actually a big Atari fan, and he wrote a little bit of the script, but the writing Pixels, there was like back and forth, like,
sure,
Chris Columbus to Tim to Adam, like back and forth. It was a long process. They had several different versions.
Yeah, and I think too, though, you know, there was a passion there, as I said before, and you know, I think with the three of them, they definitely get the history and that throwbackness, and I think that they did this really. I thought they did this great balance, and Phil, chime in as well. I think that they did this great balance of making a movie that I would have fun at, okay, mm-hmm. because they understood what it was to go to an arcade and that excitement. But at the same time, they made a movie for young adults, for kids, and who may not understand and see the Easter eggs, or maybe have never played Pac-Man, like Phil was saying before. But they made it so that it was fun for them as well. And I really thought that they did a fine balance of doing that so that everybody can enjoy it. It wasn't just made for me and the nostalgia. I'm going to throw out, it wasn't like Minions. Minions was made for like the 6 to 8 year olds.
Right.
Really? This one was made for the 6 to 8 to 9 to 12, 13 year olds. And it really was made for their parents who grew up in this era as well.
Well, also the content in Pixels were originally created back in the 70s right, and 80s. So, yeah, you're going to bring that older demographic just because of whatever they're showing, whether it be games or not.
Yeah. So Phil, how about yourself? I mean, did you get that sense as well, as it being a well-balanced film in that regards, thematically?
Yeah, I thought, you know, while it used those elements of the 80s, you know, it wasn't a crutch, right? It, at the end of the day, it told the story of a guy that, you know, was lost in the past, who wasted away his youth for nothing, was a smart guy, was a likable guy, and, you know, here you have his best friend, who's
Chewie.
Who's the president.
Right, who just happens to be president. Yeah.
And so I thought that was a great story, and you kind of gave it a fantastic context in which to play in. And
right.
that was the fun for me. And then, you know, bring back his friends, you know, Josh Gad and, you know, Peter Dinklage. It all just made this fantastic universe, you know, come alive. And that's, but at the core of it was the idea of true friendship and really kind of growing up.
Yeah. And, you know, and for Chris Columbus as well, because he's gone on, like, he hadn't seen the short.
No,
he hadn't seen the short, but he'd read the script and, you know, found out that it was a short. He saw the short after, and he was just, he loved that, the friendship thing, but he loved the universe. Like, oh my God, I get to play and I get to try to create this. And I think he did I think they all collaboratively did a very fine job, a very fun job too.
Absolutely. And a little bit more into the writing, because there were so many different versions. One of the earlier versions, Centipede and Pac-Man were written in, but Donkey Kong wasn't. That was a later version that they brought into, which I found fascinating, because Donkey Kong takes such a big type of integral part of the storyline.
Yeah, and it was all a matter of rights. You know, when you gotta think about this,
gaming rights.
Yeah, Disney did a really fun animated film called Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah.
I'm gonna wreck it, right?
Right.
Really a fun movie, and again, a very nostalgic throwback to those 8-bit graphic games and such, but they couldn't, they made games that were similar to, but they couldn't use words like Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and things like that, because they couldn't procure the rights without spending a ton of do-re-mi.
Right.
So, you know, then coming on board, trying to get these rights, it was, well, we need Donkey Kong. How do we do this? And it was, the owners of Donkey Kong, who, I forget who they are.
Nintendo.
Their main concern was, are you going to treat Donkey Kong? We don't want you to, like, disrespect our brand. And then when they showed them the script and showed them, they're like, oh, okay, no, this is great. And I didn't find that there was any... Donkey Kong did what Donkey Kong does.
There was nothing offensive.
Absolutely
or
not.
Degrading of the game that everyone grew up with and loved.
And how amazing was that set?
It was amazing. And the interesting thing about the set, it was all practical. Actors worked on a full scale, that life size Donkey Kong set.
Yeah, isn't that good, Phil? I mean, when that camera pulled back and you saw that set, I was like going, wait, that doesn't look CG. Yes, barrels and all that stuff. Don't misunderstand me. But the set and the platforms they were standing on were literal sets. And Kevin James had a hard time getting them up because he's afraid of heights.
Yeah,
but they were all on harnesses, and I was like, that's Donkey Kong. That's
climbing
awesome.
Up ladders, swinging hammers,
swinging the hammers. I thought that was great.
Phil, what were your thoughts on the Donkey Kong set?
I love Donkey Kong. You know, I thought they did a fantastic job with that. And, you know, just in general, that's kind of your climax of the movie, right? They set up really well in terms of that's the one game that you can't necessarily be good at. And obviously he's had a foe at, and I forget where exactly he finds out where Peter Dinklage cheated. You know, obviously, as an audience, we know fairly early on, but I don't think he even at that point actually knows that that's how you know he became world champion.
Right.
So there's a
he
lot.
He finds out when he's at, in the Donkey Kong. Someone tells him, he's like, no, someone cheated. And he's like, son. No, I am the, I am the champion while he's on the set. So, fortunately, good timing.
So, I thought, you know, the combination of all those elements, and when you kind of see that, and I thought, you know, it just lent, because when you're playing this, you know, for those people that have actually played the game, you know, you're just kind of controlling these things and whatever. But when you build it into an action set like that, and you see it, you know, and it's a matter of life and death type stuff, wow. Just wow.
Yeah, it was. And it was just, and again, it was fun to see him wield that hammer and like smash the barrels. Mm-hmm. like that was great. Oh, and visual effects wise, you know, I mean, we'll talk about this, but I mean, everything, all these video games like Donkey Kong and the barrels and Pac-Man, they had this wonderful like inner light that was done on purpose. Mm-hmm. And they looked great. And even when things like pixel and broke down into the little cubes and such,
that's what they call them.
That was awesome. I mean, it was great. And again it led to the fun of this movie.
Totally believable. Totally. That if you were to hit these things, you were going to disintegrate into boxes,
right? And if you if they hit you, yes, and when you blew them up, they smashed out, they scattered in these boxes. But it lent a depth to this stuff. I can tell you, I saw this in XD and in 3D, and this movie looked awesome. It looked great in 3D.
It looked great in 2D. Yeah, I can't imagine 3D.
Awesome. The centipede stuff in 3D when they were shooting up in the sky. It was great. The depth and again, they just took great time and care to make, let's make sure we get this looking right. And stuff.
Absolutely. We are kind of delving into visual effects, but just to like backtrack a little bit to Donkey Kong, and then we'll move on. This Donkey Kong set actually took up 3 sound stages.
Mm-hmm.
It was so large in scale, but it was physically impossible to get that high. So they had there were sections where there was 3 and 2 ladders, just to get up to each tier, which is fascinating.
They must have had so much fun.
Oh yeah,
like making this, right?
Being like strung up 75 to 100 feet in the air, and even Chris Columbus, when they weren't shooting, but he had to give the actors notes, he himself had to be harnessed just so they could pull him up so he could talk to the actors on the set, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, same here.
And for a movie that's really, there's a lot of visual effects, there were a lot of practical effects in this movie too.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I was researching on, Marissa, that I thought was just fantastic. Aside from the Donkey Kong set, another one of the major set pieces that's a ton of fun is the Pac-Man sequence in New York City. Using actual minis as the ghosts, which was perfect. And you couldn't have picked a better city to model your Pac-Man game after, because you know, when you look at New York, and here's why.
It's a grid system.
So you go here, left, right. It's not too much unlike playing Pac-Man on a video game.
Chicago's very much like that,
yes,
too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, if it was in Boston, it would never work because there are so many one-way streets. You'd get lost. But so I understood. And when they did the overhead shot, it was like, oh yeah, that's great. But a lot of the driving, the crashing, cars getting cut in half, a lot of that was practical. They filmed at night, doing all this stuff.
And they filmed in Toronto.
But
most of the visual effects just came from remapping all the visual effects to make it look like New York.
Yeah, it looked fine. It looked great. But I just love that they actually had stunt, like when Josh Gad is driving his car and Pac-Man's chasing him, you know, it was like, yeah, I had some guy on a bike who had these weird things, and they said, while filming it, it looked really funny. But they knew that they were just going to animate Pac-Man around it. But the rest of the stuff, flying into bricks or flying into other, or crashing into other cars, that was all very practical and really done to a great effect.
I thought the Pac-Man scene was fantastic. So much fun to watch.
It was.
Pac-Man is actually one of the games I did used to play. Granted, I wasn't great at it, but I knew it enough to actually appreciate how they visually showed it in real life, which I found fascinating. For the Pac-Man, because obviously Pac-Man was CGI'd. But again, going back to the practical effects, when they were filming, they actually used another Mini Cooper. They had a bunch of reflector lights around it. And then it also had a pole on top of the roof that stood up and had a light on top of the pole to show the how high the height of Pac-Man. Yeah. So when they go back to re-edit and put in the visual effects, they know the scale of how big Pac-Man was supposed to be.
And the cars looked cool. You know, the cars look cool in the movie, the minis. And I just love that they each have, like, it was Inky, Blinky. They're all the names of the ghosts that
there
were.
Was pink, blue, orange, no, red. And
yeah, I forget the name of the Pac-Man ghosts, but those were their names. Right. It was Inky and Blinky are the two that I'm most familiar with, but I think I'm missing two more. But that was just a ton of fun that's what their license plates read.
Yeah, and also for Pac-Man, they actually had to lower him farther into the ground because his mouth, there's a restriction in movement of his mouth. So they moved him closer into the ground that when he's going through the streets, there's a trail, he's breaking into the road, which I found fascinating because they had to lower him probably by a foot just to show that he's eating everything on the street, because if he was on top of the road, his mouth wouldn't be able to ingest everything.
Absolutely, yeah. And
which I would have never thought that at all.
No. And you know, but it's part of that's why they're making these movies. You know, that kind of thinking ahead and ingenuity, you know, comes down. They used a ton of different visual effects companies to come on in and help out with these. But all the work was seamless to me. And, you know, it looked great. You know, I wanted to... Phil, you said something up at the top of the show too. I think the concept of this movie was really smart and fun too, because we send up these time capsules out into space, and we've had
them.
Right, and NASA and you know, we've had they found our capsule and things don't look good, but the mere fact that everything that was sent in that capsule, the one thing that the aliens focused on were the video games, and that they took it as a challenge that, oh, okay.
Raging war.
This looks like fun. And, you know, and they pick video games. And again, when you think of it, it's almost like in Ghostbusters. It's like when Dan Aykroyd's character thinks about the marshmallow. He goes, I was thinking about the most innocent thing in the world. I never thought that Stay Puft Marshmallow could do this. And here we are. It's like, you know, this is just what we're doing in the 80s. We're playing video games. It's just for fun. And they take Pac-Man, one of the most innocent video games around, and they turn to him, you mean Pac-Man is a bad guy?
Right.
So, and again, Ghostbusters just did have some influence. Chris Columbus says, yeah, Ghostbusters had some influence on me in making this movie as well. And you can sort of kind of see that.
I liked how they did add the character Toru Iwatani, who is the professor and creator of the actual Pac-Man game. Although the actor who played Professor Iwatani is not him.
No, but he does have a cameo.
But he does have a cameo. He played the repairman, the video arcade repairman at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Which I would have never picked that out until I found that out.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was great. And it was all an homage to him to say, thank you, sir. You know, it was like, thanks, because, you know, we spent a lot of quarters playing your game, but you accounted for so much of, like, our childhood fun. And when video games hit that market, you know, it was something fun to do that was, like, in, you know, the video games of then are nothing like the video games today. They were very innocent, simple, fun, innocent types of games that, from kid to adult. I mean, when you went into an arcade, it wasn't just teenagers. I mean, there were adults in there. So sometimes you could walk into an arcade, see somebody in their business suit playing, like, Pac-Man. You know, they were taking a break from work, or they were, you know, a lot of the arcades were in malls. So sometimes, like, the employees or the managers would take their break and go into the arcade room and plunk a couple of quarters in to play Pac-Man.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of businesses have that in their break rooms. I mean, I believe YouTube Space LA here mm-hmm. in Los Angeles has a break room that is filled with arcade yeah. games.
You're from Chicago. You know, Phil and I were from the East Coast. I can't even remember going into a pizza place that didn't have an arcade.
Right.
That didn't have an arcade game in it. That you know, and
or even bowling places.
Oh, bowling places,
bowling
huge.
Alleys,
absolutely.
Bunch of arcades.
7-Elevens.
This switches directions a little bit.
Yeah,
but in terms of the structure, it reminded me very much of like Mortal Kombat, in the sense of you know, there the first Mortal Kombat, you know, you're fighting for souls type thing. And, you know, they're slightly different rules, but there's a number that you're trying to hit, and
right.
after that you gain dominance, right?
Right.
And so in this regard, it's, you know, three lives, and from there. And I felt we kind of went through the first two a little bit quick, and then, you know, when our team starts winning, that's where we really start focusing. And I did enjoy that aspect of it, but just the comparison I wanted to make.
Yeah, no, it's a fun comparison. You know, one of the things I was hoping for was that we would get the power up level. Like, we would get the power up or the extra live. Because, like, when you were playing an arcade game, the goal was not just to, like, get to the end of the game or complete all levels. It was to gain as many extra lives that would help you get to the end of the game.
Right.
And I was wondering for where that was, but there was no reset button, which I like that they said.
Yeah. And actually, you saying extra life, I was kind of hoping, as dark as this may sound, I was kind of hoping to see what happened to them if they did die in the game.
Yeah.
It's like, how would they get regenerated? What happened to them? Do they automatically lose? And I wanted to see that, but I'm glad they didn't, because I did love how they had that restriction. Like, we have to win three games, and whoever...
We have three lives.
Three lives. You know, whoever wins the most, two out of three,
right.
whatever, is the winner. And I liked how they had somewhat of that time limit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because that's how video games were. You got three lives, and that was it. Once they were done... You had to put in another quarter and start back from the beginning.
Right. And this film kind of reminded me of Scott Pilgrim Against the World.
Oh, okay.
That film, there's a lot of video gaming components in that film, which was also another film visually well done with a lot of their gaming effects
right.
as well.
The problem with that movie, though, that I just think it was Scott Pilgrim Against and whatever. It was too much. It was seven things that he had to deal with, and mm-hmm. it was just so long, you know? Whereas this, it set up the story, and it was quick, you know?
It was quick.
You got through it. You didn't have to go through every obstacle for, like, 20 minutes, and it would have been like, okay, by the end, you would have been like, I don't care who wins. Just get this over with.
Right.
You know, whereas this, you really cared for the whole thing. I mean, when they took down the Taj Mahal, that was a fun scene. It didn't need to go longer than it needed to.
It was a really fun scene.
And that was taken down by, which game was that?
Taj Mahal.
Started with the G's, but wasn't Galaxia?
Galactica, I think. It wasn't, because Galaga came a little bit later on in the game. Or I think in the movie. But, the Taj Mahal scene was a lot of fun. I love this, again, the centipede scene was a ton of fun, too. Like, that scene out in the park in England, like, that was great. And Kevin James and the woman who played the queen, they were great. They were great together. And Sean Bean, there was some great rapport there.
Into the cast, there was a fun lineup.
It really was.
Obviously, we have Adam Sandler, very known for his comedy, and his friend Kevin James, also part of this film. But we had a lot of dramatic actors in this film, which was fairly refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a whole nother side of these actors that I really didn't see. Like Peter Dinklage, obviously from Game of Thrones, most known from that. Michelle Monaghan. I mean, there's so many names that were, I know personally,
right.
as dramatic actors.
I want to talk about Peter Dinklage for a second, because I really appreciate that this guy is really going out of his way, like when he's not doing Game of Thrones, he's taking on projects like Pixels. You know, like his character couldn't be any farther removed than Tyrion Lannister, in which, and you get the sense that he has this freedom. And when he's in Pixels, like when he comes walking out, he's got this cocky demeanor. He's like, ooh, 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 ooh. Like, mm-hmm. You just can't help but laugh. Like, I thought Peter Dinklage, in every scene he was in, even though he was the obnoxious bad guy, he just made me laugh. I thought it was very funny. He fit into the Adam Sandler crew, like, seamlessly.
Totally. And I think the same goes for Josh Gad. I really found his character very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very funny, too. Oh, I love Josh Gad. Yeah, Ludlow, and he even got to sing.
Like, a little bit. Know?
Yeah, and he did an 80s classic, too. Yeah, I thought bringing Josh Gad into the fold, really, too. I've been in love with Michelle Monaghan since Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And seeing her in this movie, she's a breath of fresh air to look at. But it's also, number one, she has a killer smile, but you could tell that she was having fun in this film. I love it when actors give the appearance that they're having fun making a movie, like this crew does. And man, oh man, Ashevitz, when she walked out in that green dress, even before Brenner said it, Adam Sandler's character was like, wow, she looks really great in green. And then he gets up and says, green is my favorite color. Like, knockout. And she was good too. I thought the rapport between her and Sandler, they had good chemistry.
I definitely believe Michelle Monaghan, you know, playing opposites Adam Sandler. Because every Adam Sandler film, you always have to have his female component.
Mm-hmm.
There's always that female. And I really liked her, and compared to all the other females that he's had in all of his past films, I think she really stood on her own. And the fact that she was such a strong female, strong feminist type of character.
Absolutely.
Who can hold her own, kill a Smurf. I'm
right.
Like, all right.
Right.
I was rooting for her.
Yeah, I liked her. Oh, you know, you just brought up a very interesting scene. When she kills a Smurf, right? In the trailer, it was Kevin James' character that kills a Smurf, and he says the same. He says, don't tell anybody I killed a Smurf. Like, did you catch that, Phil?
Yeah, it was different.
Like, yeah, it was completely different.
I caught there was definitely some things from the trailer that were different. That one in particular, I don't know if it's a matter of they wanted her to have a little bit more versus Kevin James, or if it made the president look too weird. I don't know, but hey, I certainly laughed in the movie, and I also, you know, for what it's worth, I got a laugh out of it in the trailer. So
right.
They got two different laughs out of me with the same joke.
Yeah, and
that,
you know,
didn't bother me.
And what I liked was they pulled a switcheroo. I saw something different that wasn't in the trailer. Same line, and
yeah.
To your point, it made it seem a little fresh. Like when it happened, the recall hit. So, but I didn't have any problems with Michelle Monaghan. So what about you and the cast? Like, what are your thoughts on...
We're best friends. What about it? No. I thought everyone was, you know, it was really all, obviously it hinged on Adam Sandler's character for the most part, but every one of them was fantastic. And they, you know, part, it started with, they were really well fleshed out. You understood their relationships. You understood her annoyance with him right off the bat of like, who's this nerd IT guy? He's hitting on me just because we shared a bottle together doesn't mean we're sharing spit together.
Okay, they're snobby. Yeah.
But that, you know, and then it just kept going. And so, you know, all these relationships just were fantastic to watch.
Yeah.
And even the kid when he, you know, because the kid, you think kind of he's just like this throwaway character. But they gave him a lot more, where he's the one who finds out that that our friend Peter Dinklage cheated.
Right.
Right.
And he wasn't an annoying kid either. You know, and in fact, I like the rapport, I like the dialogue between Brennan and the kid, because obviously, again, it gapped the generation gap, in which Sandler was telling him the games he used to play are completely different from the games that this kid is now playing. And, you know, he goes, we had no reset buttons. He goes, games were, you know, you had a pattern and all this.
I feel like there are three different generations in this film. You have Adam Sandler's generation, Josh Gad's generation from, like, the mid-20s, late-30s. And then you had the son's generation. So there were multiple... demographics that could watch this film.
That's weird, too, because I always felt like Josh Gad, I thought he was there, he and Kevin James, sort of kind of like a peer. Because they were, weren't they friends back in the 80s?
They were.
They went to the...
Ludlow. Seemed like a few years younger than the main two, Kevin James and Adam Sandler. But which I still like because Josh Gad is always funny. I think his standout scene in the film was when he was yelling at all the
all the soldiers
because he's trying to get over his fear and he just comes out yelling. I was dying.
He was hysterical.
I was legit.
Yeah, he goes, "How'd I do that? That was awful." but I also, and again, just talking with the kid, it's like you have Sandler, Brennan going, "Yeah, our games. You had patterns that you had to try to figure out." He goes, "How do you play your games?" He goes, "You pretend you're the character and you try not to die.
Try not to die.
And that's exactly how you play these games today. It's like, yeah, you shoot, you run, you jump, you take cover, and you try not to die."
And I liked how some shots we did get that first-person perspective shooter that the younger, our current generation now is so well-known for, for Halo and all those plus games that I won't mention.
Right.
But there were a few shots to that to see everyone's perspective of how they're destroying all these characters.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, that's a lot of fun. And again, just bringing it back to it really, when the movie was over, I actually had the urge to go home and see, check on Xbox if I could download like a Pac-Man or some of my favorite games from that era just to play them on my television screen.
I was a big Frogger.
Frogger, I was huge with Frogger on Atari.
Yeah.
And I'll go into a list later. You know, ironically, why didn't I just walk into the Dave and Buster's? I was right across the way from the theater. I guess I had the movie and I wanted to
You were in the mood.
I was in the mood.
There you go. Okay. Let's go a little bit back to the visual effects because there was so much, like, cinematography-wise. I thought it was brilliant how they executed this film.
Oh,
especially for, I mean, it was a very, very simple story, but visually very complicated, but it looks so seamless. And that's what I really loved. Matthew Butler, who was this VFX supervisor, he had a lot to say about the actual making of all the 3D effects. You know, the movie's called Pixels, which is the word pixels called pixels and imaging, but what the creative aspect that they use for this film is called voxels, which is actually a combination of volume and light.
Right.
Which is, I mean, in for visual aspects, it's more protruding. If you're watching it, it's a cube that protrudes out into the 3D space.
Yep. And to me, too, like that 8 megabyte graphic or such, they could have gone that route, but I think the way that they created the Pac-Mans, the Q-Berts, who we haven't even talked about yet, the centipedes, they gave them that look, but they gave them a new shine, which I felt, you know, very much needed, because if you are going to bring in that younger audience, they need more than just what they look like. You know, Pac-Man would have been flat, you know, eating things. You couldn't do that. And I really felt that they did a
Donkey great... Kong would have been flat.
Donkey Kong, yeah. And he would have just gone side to side. Like
a lot of them were 2D games.
Yeah. And the 3D aspect that they added to them still gave them the look and feel of what that older generation was accustomed to. Mm-hmm. They get it. But the kids, it's going to bring those kids in and go, "Wow, that looks great. It looks shiny. Maybe they'll go back and try to play Donkey Kong again. I don't know." It just looked. They did a fantastic job with all their visual effects. I felt.
I love the light emitting effect. They called it light energy. Peter Wenham, one of the production designers, came up with the idea of light energy, where, you know, it emits light from an internal source, but it allowed the cubes to retain a simple geometric shape. Because obviously cubes, but it shows the complexity of the surface that it's burning through, and also gives dimension in a darker space. Because if you think about it, Toronto, well, when they filmed in Toronto, right. And Pac-Man scene was mostly at night. So right. how do you show Pac-Man in darkness? You emanate light from
right.
within.
And all of them, too. Like, there was a scene where the first guy that the aliens kidnapped was the military guy. And they broke through a wall in which, they shot through the wall and those cubes are on the ground and it was a cool effect. I don't know if you noticed, but when he was stepping over, like, you know, the hole in the wall.
He kicked the cube.
Yeah, and he kicked the cube, but the cubes are also very reflective and stuff. And I thought that was really cool. It was a very nice touch. And if you're going to break pixels down, a great way to visualize that, to give that concept, was the cubes. Like, mm-hmm. in making that, you know, make everything fall down in cubes like that.
Exactly. And to add to the falling everywhere, because they were emanating light, every time they fell, they would lose the light and would right. lose, also losing its energy at the same
sure.
time.
Yeah.
Which, fascinating. I love learning this stuff.
Yeah, and revoxelize as they moved. It felt more digital. Yeah, I mean, they at least, and again, when we're talking about something that's original, they actually did, you know, they polished up the hubcaps. Like, they're not showing us anything, like, we're familiar with the Pac-Man game, but mm-hmm. they brought it into such a way and into this original story that wasn't a sequel or anything. You know, I have to say that again, but they made it look different and new. And I think that it was really, I think it's key that they get somebody like Chris Columbus, who's no stranger to making big special effects movies.
Hello, Harry Potter.
Hello. You know, and then even Percy Jackson. And so,
right.
you know, he gets it. So I think that it was a coup to get Chris Columbus on board. It's a little out of his wheelhouse, filming, you know, making an Adam Sandler kind of a movie, but it was the right choice, because if anybody knows how to rein that in and how to shoot that with great effect, Chris Columbus is a great guy. He's a great go-to guy to, you know, on so many levels, like we talked about in the writing earlier. He gets that. You know, he used to write those kind of escapist kind of movies, whether it be Goonies or Gremlins and
Absolutely.
Such. So.
And what I appreciated about this movie was that even the whole big showdown scene when they're all in Washington, D.C., yeah. and all the characters are out in the streets destroying everything, they had so many different games and quick shots and odes uh-huh. to classic games that I personally probably missed a lot of them, but you might have picked up on some of them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, some of them happened so fast, and there was so much in there that I know that I probably missed a lot. I know the ones that I picked out and got, and I was like, oh, I remember that. Made me very happy. Like I said, earlier, Paperboy. I love seeing Paperboy. Frogger was in there. Like, the frog was in there.
They did have Mario for a quick second.
I missed. And again, like, I don't even remember Mario as a, I didn't remember Mario as an arcade game, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, he was always born of the Nintendo console.
It was the Donkey Kong version of Mario before Super Mario's version.
So, you know, all of these games, having Galaga, they didn't have Missile Command, which is just basically lines coming down. There were a bunch that I was sort of looking for. Ghosts and Goblins was another one of my favorites that I was looking for, that little knight to come. But they had, didn't they even do Tetris?
Yeah, they did
Tetris
for the building yep. destroying. That uh-huh. was pretty fun. They had Q-Bert. Which I mean, I never played that game, but I very recognizable.
Yeah,
for
you
such
know,
a simple shape.
And again, for me, I don't recall playing Q-Bert in an arcade. For me, he came along. I played Q-Bert a lot on the consoles, but they made him such a great character, and Q-Bert has a nice payoff at the end for Josh Gad.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about Q-Bert, because he's really not known for emoting emotions in that way, the visual effects had to really create Q-Bert as a character that had a lot of comedic moments. So the facial expressions, and also because he is such a more round character, they had to have lower resolution on his surface.
Yeah,
and have more resolution around his face in the eyebrow area.
Yeah, I had heard that he was like the hardest character to foxalize, so to speak. And it's funny because in the video game of Q-Bert, you know, the character does have a personality. He spoke in little comedic comic book bubbles that had symbols in there. Mm-hmm. So like you get what he was saying. But I really liked, you know, when he was feeding him popcorn. That was awesome. That was really cool. I like that scene.
He sucked it up like a vacuum. What do we think of the lady that Q-Bert turns into for Josh Gad's character? Is she a real game, or was she just completely made up?
I believe she was a real game. I forget what they said it in the movie. It wasn't a game. It was a fighting game. Much like a Mortal Kombat type of a fighting game,
played by Ashley Benson.
And and it's nice that they explain that, because when Q-Bert didn't disappear, but yet her character did when it was game over for the alien, so to speak. I was like, wait a minute, how does that work? Like, why is Q-Bert still around if they all got? And then they explain, well, Q-Bert was a trophy. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Trophy wife now.
Now he's a trophy wife. But wasn't it a great little punchline at the end of the movie? 1 year later?
Right.
And they have little Q-Berts in the crib jumping up and down? I thought that was funny. Nice little payoff.
Phil, what did you think of Q-Bert? Did you find him entertaining?
I found him absolutely entertaining. I thought it was a great little punchline of, you know, hey, Is anyone else not freaked out by that right now? which I was a little freaked out by, but it was good to see.
But still, ended everyone on a fun laugh.
Yeah, so. And again, like Josh Gad's character Ludlow was so heartbroken and devastated when she disappeared. And again, their fight scene and their quote unquote courtship, you know, like only happens in the movies. I mean, but it was fantastic. It was so fun.
It was absolutely ridiculous to watch.
Absolutely.
I mean, watching it, you do have to admit that. You would never, no offense, and I don't mean to take this in the wrong way, you wouldn't think Ludlow would ever get with Lady Lisa, but I'm still happy that he got a happy ending with a character that we saw his character growing up always loving Lady Lisa and now actually having an interaction with her and getting what he wanted.
Yep.
It's like, yes, he deserves that. I mean, to him to have a happy ending, it's like, I was okay with how ridiculous, even though it was ridiculous, it was still very fun to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about one of the fun cameos, and it wasn't a video game cameo, so to speak, but it was an excellent 80s cameo, and it was Max Headroom, who comes in. He was the big head with the glasses. He was the pixelized computer thing. There was a big television show, Max Headroom, big in the 80s, voiced by Matt Feuer. And I was like, oh my god, they even have Max Headroom is even featured in Back to the Future 2 to an extent.
Right.
So,
showing my age, I wasn't part of that demographic.
I understand. I get it. But I just loved the fact that they had Max Headroom in this movie.
I love the fact because, yes, we did get the whole preface that this, you know, back in 1982, they sent up the footage into space. But I liked how when they had the time capsule and relaying the messages back to Earth, that they had all big, iconic 80s people giving the message. Like
Madonna.
Hall & Oates.
Hall & Oates.
I mean, and then you have Headroom.
TV sets. It was awesome.
The interesting thing about that for this film, they actually got Madonna and Hall & Oates to record new footage, and then it was, I believe, Digital Domain that went over and did all the image,
the de-aging
process of them. But it was actually new footage that was, they said those new lines.
And it's good for them. I mean, you know, because they got into the spirit of it all. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was really fun to see them do that. I think that's one of the nice little bonuses that you get in this movie from a nostalgia standpoint. You know, and maybe the kids are going, who's that? But, you know, maybe now they'll be tuned into Hall & Oates.
I mean, at least I know who Hall & Oates are.
You know what MTV is.
I was singing Hall & Oates yesterday. I kid you not. So, I'm not that young.
I mentioned Ghostbusters earlier. I mean, Dan Aykroyd has a cameo in this movie. And not only does Dan Aykroyd have a cameo, but his vodka has a cameo in the movie as well. I believe it's called Crystal Skull Vodka. I mean, I don't see what other name it is, but there is a scene where one of the characters, they're at a bar and they're drinking vodka and it comes in a crystal skull. That's Dan Aykroyd's vodka.
Good to know. I did not know that. Very, very fun. Okay, let's go into the reception and whatnot of this film. A lot of people aren't enjoying it as much as we did.
No. And Phil, you and I were having a big conversation about this a little bit prior to the start of this. Now, from somewhere in the depths of the Hollywood bowels system, there has become, in my opinion, this great hatred for Adam Sandler. I don't know where it comes from. I don't contribute to it, but people seem to really loathe him in a way that's different from other actors. And when you look at Pixels, let's talk Pixels, and then we'll talk about a couple of other Adam Sandler upcoming endeavors. This movie has been totally focused on box office and Adam Sandler being dead at the box office. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's like we were talking too about reviews. The reviews of this movie weren't even so much about the movie. They were about
Adam Sandler. No, I know.
And you know, when you talk about this movie, let's talk box office just a little bit. And first off, the production budget on this movie is $88 million. The flat-out production. The all-in hard drives and advertising, $145 million. Which for a movie like this, that's sort of kind of low, right? You think? That's not bad. I mean, for a movie of this, Jurassic World is a hell of a lot more, I believe. So, you know, and then it comes out and it does an opening weekend domestic gross of $24 million. And everybody is like, oh, Adam Sandler's dead at the box office. Adam Sandler's box office poison. Adam Sandler's this and that. Number one, I don't know where this hatred comes from, because when you look at Adam Sandler movies, yes, I do agree that he has a certain type of comedy. I find it to be, for the most part, it's highly inoffensive. It's childish buffoonery. And I say, what the hell is wrong with that? You know, I can take a raunchy comedy, you know, as well. But, you know, we are in the age of raunch-com a lot. But his is a little bit more childish, silly, and so what? If it makes me laugh, that's fine. When you span a career, not all your movies are going to be great because you do so many projects. He has a deep loyalty to his friends and family. Again, I say, what is wrong with that? You know, he's helped Colin Quinn. He's put him in, you know, Kevin James. They've been in movies together, what, 11 times?
Nine times?
Right? And, you know, what Adam Sandler has produced and brought to theatrics and into the world of cinema, again, from a creative standpoint, yeah, it's silly humor. Billy Madison. It's a silly movie, but it's funny. Happy Gilmore. Again, another, it's a funny movie. Mm-hmm. It's good stuff, but it's silliness. And I don't think when Adam Sandler goes to make a movie, I don't think he's thinking of getting a ton of awards or whatever. I think he's just going out there to make a comedy that'll make for an hour and a half. I think he just wants to make people laugh.
Right. And, you know, from the reviews that I read, a lot of people who dislike the movie, I mean, there were some jabs at the comedy, but comedy, it depends on what kind of comedy you like. If it's slapstick, this movie might be for you. But if it's for just, like, punchlines and whatnot, there were a couple that stuck. It's like, Have you been playing a lot of Space Invaders? Yes, how can you tell? Like, because right. you're invading my space. That was funny.
Right.
But there are other lines that may not have stuck, but you shouldn't hate a whole movie just because you didn't like two jokes.
In every comedy, not every joke is going to work. Even a movie like Airplane, okay? You take
Great
a movie like Airplane that has a joke coming at your face, like, within every minute. Mm-hmm. Not all of them work, but... You know, you throw what's out there. And Adam Sandler, I think he gets that. And I just want to say something that nobody who's been writing the reviews on this, everybody seems to forget. And again, there's such seething hatred that I believe it really seeped into the reviews. But nobody has said that, you know, as an actor, in the movies that he's been in, his lifetime, he's contributed $2.4 billion at box office.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now catch this. As a producer of movies and such.
Happy Madison.
He yep. contributed $2.6 million. But I'm sorry, billion. Billion, that is with a B. Billion dollars. And, you know, we were talking about his box office. Okay. So... Blended didn't do so well, okay?
But I really enjoyed that film.
Okay, that opened up about a year ago. 2 years ago, because you were saying he was big in the 90s. Well, Grown Ups 2 did $133 million. That was Grown Ups 2, okay? Hotel Transylvania, which he produced, wrote it.
Great movie.
Okay, $148 million at the box office. That's my boy. That's my boy.
Phil was a big fan of that.
Okay, and that came out in 2012. As well, okay, so that one didn't do so well. That was $36 million. A movie that got panned universally, Jack and Jill, did $74 million.
That's a terrible
okay.
movie.
Now, and just go with it. I'm talking about movies. Whoops. That was an Adam Sandler.
Spill.
That was great.
I'm spilling in the studio here.
Yeah, but he had a movie called Just Go With It. $103 million at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, he had Grown Ups in 2010. So this is within the last 5 years. Grown Ups did $162 million. So within the past 5 years, he's had one, two, three, four. Four movies in the past 5 years that went over $100 million. And yet this town, these critics, these people hate Adam Sandler. It's
unfortunate because, yes, going off of that, it's amazing how quickly people forget how many successful movies he's had in his past. Then you come up with one that may not have done, and they're all focusing on the negative.
Yeah,
but that's why they're called critics.
But they're focusing on the negative in such a dispassionate way that I believe it's clouding what the review of the movie is. I said that for me, I found this movie highly way more entertaining than, say, Chappie was.
Oh,
okay.
So much.
And that director is getting the keys to the car to do the Alien franchise, and his movies have been declining in box office with everything that he puts out. I found this movie.
That? Eric Blomkamp?
Neil Blomkamp.
Neil Blomkamp.
Okay. So close. I found this movie to be more entertaining than last summer raunchy comedy, Neighbors. I had more fun with Pixels and it being silly humor. I want to understand why people have been spewing this hatred towards him. Phil, you had brought up a really good point regarding Netflix. So
indeed,
yeah. So go ahead,
developing things for Netflix.
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, it's as simple as he signed a 4-year movie deal with Netflix, and for me, you know, everyone's. I'm sure this is. I'll let you talk about has he sunk that low. But for me, the fact of the matter is, you know, Netflix started off. We got all excited when they were doing, you know, 3 shows a year, and they were fantastic, right?
Yep.
I forget the exact order, but House of Cards and
Orange is the New Black,
and so on. Sure. And now there's a new Netflix series coming out. Pretty much every single week.
Yeah, it seems that way, right?
I mean, honestly, getting like Wet Hot saturated. American Summer is down the pipeline.
It's already up.
There you go. Orange is the New Black just came out recently. You know, so there's so many. Daredevil has been great. And so Netflix has really risen to the ranks where they're in contention for the Emmys in term, and in terms of TV, that's huge.
Huge. And, huge. And, you know, and everybody who signed a deal with Netflix, Kevin Spacey, Marvel, Orange is the New Black folk, like all of these people, like they were lauded for their efforts. Kevin Spacey's on there and he's getting Emmy nominations and all this stuff. Adam Sandler signs a four-picture deal and they're going, look how low he has sunk. What the hell?
Are you kidding
me? Like, are you, oh my God, it's like, is this the end of Adam Sandler? He's signing deals with Netflix? And the only one who's coming up to his defense is Ted Sarandos. I believe that's his name. The CEO of Netflix saying, we are so proud to have Netflix. His mm-hmm. movies are some of the most downloaded movies on our streaming service. And Adam Sandler gets, look how low he's sung, he's doing Netflix, and everybody else gets praise and applause.
No, no. To add to that.
I don't get it.
Sarandos, because he defended Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
He, and I quote, said, Pixels did 24 million domestic opening, and for that, and also did 25 million international. A third of our subscribers, speaking about Netflix, are outside of the US, and we did our deal with Adam Sandler because he's an enormous international global movie star. And that 50 million for Pixels is pretty respectable, and I think will continue to grow. So it's not just because maybe it didn't do good in America, maybe the Americans didn't like it, but Adam Sandler as a whole in the bigger scope of everything is way more successful than people make him out to be.
Well, they're not giving
him the credit.
And Netflix
is the best platform for him to be on. And the fact that Netflix is making films, original full-out feature-length films now instead of just TV series, is just showing how much Netflix is growing itself.
Yeah, and that's all well and good. I just don't want this to be... A lot of the criticism, they're really... They're hammering the nails in Adam Sandler's theatrical box office career. They're hammering the nails in that. And I, you know, again, it's, you know, I read comments on our YouTube thing a lot and mm-hmm. I've taken some hits. And you know, I'll be honest, it doesn't feel good, especially when some anonymous person.
We've all taken hits.
Right. But it doesn't feel good, right? I mean, you know, no. I don't particularly like it. I can't imagine what somebody like Adam Sandler might feel when every single article is saying he's done, he's dead, his movies stink. You know, I can't even imagine how he feels when it seems like the whole industry and then some. And people who, I mean, I can't even imagine what the social media is about him. It bothers me. Because when I and you know, nobody, Chris Columbus isn't taking any flack for making this movie. He doesn't get any shrapnel. And again, I got nothing against Chris Columbus. Mm-hmm. It would have been nice if maybe Chris said, hey guys, what the hell? You know, it was a fantastic working experience with him. He said that in interviews, that making this movie was a lot of fun for him.
And it was a dream come true for Josh Gad, because he always wanted to work with Chris Columbus.
And I'm sure Adam Sandler as well. And, you know, to put Kevin James in the movie, you know, again, and folks,
as ridiculous as his character would be, being elected to president, like, all right, I wouldn't believe it, but I'll accept it.
I buy it in this movie.
And it totally helps with the storytelling. This, like, yes, he allows his friend/nerds to take over and actually execute this to save the country.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't know Adam Sandler. He doesn't owe me money as far as I'm concerned. Have I seen every Adam Sandler movie down the pike? No, I haven't.
I own a lot of Adam Sandler movies.
Yeah,
actually.
But I've seen many of them. His album, They're All Gonna Laugh at You. Come on, They're All Gonna Laugh at You. That's one of the funny, that's a great skit. Toll Booth Willie, at a medium pace. I mean, this guy has been making me laugh since his Saturday Night Live days and moving on up in through movies. And I don't care that it's childish buffoonery. I don't care. Mm-hmm. To me, that can be funny. And it's also a freshness. It because it changes the pace of a lot of what we see. I love movies like Ted and stuff. Don't get me wrong. I don't mind a raunchy comedy. But when I see an Adam Sandler comedy, I do know that I'm going to get a certain brand type of humor that might be, it's not highbrow comedy.
No.
But why does it have to be?
And like, I love Adam Sandler, but almost, and I won't say all films, but most of his characters that he portrays, his character is always like the somewhat lazy, but always maybe down on his luck or mm-hmm. is faced with a challenge.
Right.
And you, so you're always rooting for Adam Sandler, and you see his whole character arc every single movie, despite it might be very repetitive, just change one or two different elements, but it's still the same type of arc.
Right.
And I think Adam Sandler does great every single time, despite he might have done it 20 plus times now since however long he started ago. But I don't mind it because it's so successful for him. Keep doing it.
Yeah. And again, but it's innocent humor. Who is he hurting?
No one.
Like, I don't understand. Like, there are bad directors out there, people. Like, look at Uwe Boll. Like, Uwe Boll is probably, perhaps, like, could be the Ed Wood of this generation. And he has such an attitude thinking that everything he makes, like, he literally thinks that his movies are high art. Adam Sandler does not go out there claiming that my movies are high art. Yeah, I got fart jokes in my movies, for crying out loud. You know, it's
fart jokes.
Yeah, he didn't have any in this. I was a little bit surprised at it. But I'm just like, Adam Sandler doesn't pretend that his movies are any highbrow. And you know, kids have liked his movies. He really appreciates families and kids. And I know Hotel Transylvania 2 is going to be coming out soon as well.
I'm very excited for that.
You know, I just say lay off on the hate. And if you are going to hate the movie, don't do it because Adam Sandler. Don't blame Adam Sandler for box office woes. Just like, just critique, talk about the movie and why it was such a bad movie.
Do you think also because we know Adam Sandler is currently in process of working with Netflix and all these films, he did get a lot of criticism from working on the Ridiculous Six film, mm-hmm. and a lot of Native Americans were offended by the content that was in the films. Not Adam Sandler. Even Adam Sandler has blatantly stated out, he's like, there's no offensive things towards the Native Americans. We respect them. We honor them. There's nothing against them personally. And it was just that the Native Americans didn't like the content and the jokes that were in the film.
Right.
It was nothing against them personally as a race or as a nationality.
Right. You know, and again, it's hard for me to say because I haven't seen the movie.
They're still in the process, but it's unfortunate that there's now criticism towards that. So
right.
going now having Pixels following up with that fairly recently after that, it's a lot of hate towards Sandler right now.
There's a lot out there, and it's just, I just find it so unjustified. $2.4 billion mm-hmm. as an actor, $2.6 billion as a producer. You know, people seem to really like to work with him, And again, I don't know the guy. The only thing I hold against Adam Sandler is that he's a native born and raised in Massachusetts, not too far outside of Boston. And he, you know, New York is his home, which is fine, but he's a Yankees fan. That's all I hold against him, really. That's
Yankees
it. Fan. That's all I really hold
but
against
he
him.
He is a Boston Celtics fan.
Yeah.
So
and
I'll give him that.
And, you know, he likes sports. And come on, the Hanukkah song. You know, people, you were loving him when he did that song.
Yeah.
And that gets played annually
during. That's a ridiculous
movie.
But
look at the song.
Nights.
Everybody loves that song every time they play it around Christmas time. And yet,
he didn't sing in this film.
No. Which is, fine. Phil, like, you had some good points, too, when we were having this very heated conversation. But I believe that you were in agreement.
I don't think it was heated between us.
No. Well, it was passionate. It was a passionate conversation.
Fair enough. I mean, I just think he's done good movies. Not every movie he's done is good. I think Jack and Jill was, yes, the worst piece of shit on earth. You know, but okay, that's one movie. That's My Boy. Not a bad movie. Other movies, yes, perhaps a little bit bad. Do I
like
care for grown-ups?
No,
I don't care. But you know. Pixels, what I think the success of it was that he took, even though it is his vehicle, he took himself a little bit out of it, made it more about the story, and that's why it worked. Whereas Jack and Jill, it just hinges on his comedy.
Sure.
Yeah. But this, you know, I think he did recognize the criticism. I think, you know, he took that to heart. I don't care what anybody else says. They do read the papers. And he applied it. And so to not recognize that in Pixels, I think is... Is it idiotic?
I think it's completely idiotic. And, you know, I was fortunate. I was at Universal when they released Billy Madison. Ah, and at that time, I was at Adam Sandler. It's a funny, again, extremely sophomoric, like silly humor, but it was funny. So Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, then he does a movie called Bulletproof. Then he does the Wedding Singer, which I think is the movie that really crossed over for him, right? But then he does Happy Gilmore, but the movie
Big
that
Daddy.
Really, well, he did Big Daddy and Waterboy.
Yes.
Okay. So Wedding Singer, Waterboy, Big Daddy was really big for him, but then he comes out with Little Nicky. And Little Nicky, at that point, that was his first foray into cinema failure. And again, everybody was like, oh, he was terrible. But then he comes back and he does Mr. Deeds, which did $126 million. This is after a movie that did not even $40 million. He rebounds with a $126 million movie. Then he was in Punch Drunk Love. Which I
thought this is more dramatic, more serious.
But I thought
movies.
He was so good in that movie in such a smart role. That is actually one of my P.T. Barnum Anderson's. That's one of my favorite movies of his. That There Will Be Blood, I'm a really big fan of. But I'm a fan of Punch Drunk Love. You know, and then he does Eight Crazy Nights, Anger Management, which is a $135 million movie. 50 First Dates, which is a $120 million movie. You know, he did The Longest Year. He did Spanglish, which was a James Brooks film, I believe.
Yeah.
Again, a little bit more in the serious role. Click, The
Click.
Longest Yard, $158 million. That's a Burt Reynolds remake movie.
So overall, like, most of his films are very consistent.
$100 million movies.
Very consistent.
Yeah, and I just don't...
Like, if you take the average of that, that's way better than a lot of different actors.
Well, the average is, catch this, the average of his career as an actor, $78.9 million.
Wow.
That's the average. Good God, folks. You know, you hope that somebody could have a star.
If you call that failure,
right,
then you really don't know what failure is.
Yeah, and absolutely. Good God, folks. If that's what you're calling, you're pinning failure on, and the guy's had comebacks, he's tried to do different things. Good God.
And I think it just might be tough because he's mostly comedy, and comedy is so selective with people.
Sure.
It's very selective with people.
But it's so funny that in this business that you can be riding on the top for so long, they're just itching for you to fail. And when you fail, and again, like, okay, so great. Blended didn't do that great. But Grown Ups 2 was a $133 million movie. Maybe it didn't do as well as Grown Ups, but you're still broaching $100 million.
But also, Grown Ups, in fairness, had a lot of other strong male comedic actors, and that's that brought more men and more viewers to the film.
Yeah,
to the movie.
But again, I understand that Blended did $46 million, but that's when they really started to pounce. And then Pixels comes out and does, you know, its lifetime gross thus far is about $35 million or so. We were talking about international gross. We've got about $60+ million.
Yeah.
So internationally?
The weekend, it opened up to a little bit more than $24 million. It was ranked number 2, I mean, which isn't bad.
And it was pretty tight between that and Ant-Man. So,
right.
You know, but Rotten Tomatoes, 18%.
They killed it.
Yeah.
But
it's a B on CinemaScore. Yeah, which, you know, a lot of people will tell you that a B in CinemaScore is not that great because the word of mouth is meh. Listen, I think because of all the negative press, it's almost like the Tomorrowland effect. When all that negativity gets out there and seeps in, people just tend to buy into it.
And that's all you want to see and watch.
And that's all you're going to want to, that's all you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not make that effort to go see Pixels, where you might have a good time. You know, and
no, Phil and I, we saw Pixels together for the first time, but we planned a few days before that. It was like, we're going to go see Pixels. We wanted to see this film.
Yeah, I really wanted to see it as
well. Despite what people were saying about it.
Same here. And I walked out going, yep, another movie that just is not as bad as the critics would have you believe. Hey, Phil, I don't know if you're watching. Is anybody, like, watching us live have any similar?
We are not streaming live today.
We're not streaming live today. But sorry about that.
Still a fun conversation. So everyone watching later, when you're watching and listening to us, well, let us know. What did you think of Pixels? Rate, comment, review us. Anatomy of a Movie on iTunes. Definitely check that out. Yeah.
This is not a game. It's not a game. Lighten up on Adam Sandler. And remember, it was a collaborative effort.
It was.
And they all collaborated very well together.
So, real quick, what was your most favorite game that you've ever played?
Oh my God. Arcade? I have to go with Space Invaders. For me, was the one that really brought me into the arcades. Pac-Man came a little bit later, but Space Invaders for me, I mean, I got so many. I mean, Tron, Killer Shark, when Star Wars was turned into a video game. Fantastic. How about yourself?
I was more of a Frogger Pac-Man type of
Frogger
chick. Frogger Pac-Man type of chick. Phil, how about you?
The old games, let's see. Yeah, that's a tough Pac-Man. You know, I mean, it's just a classic. I think, you know, because it got re-syndicated to a lot of various things. But I also like the where you controlled the little plane and it shot stuff. I thought that was
good. Oh yeah, it was a Time Pilot or something, and you're in like the little biplane sort of thing. Is that
the one? Yeah, something like that, there was like a classic Aladdin game. This is more computer type stuff, okay. Not necessarily arcade, but Aladdin was kind of a classic. And Prince, remember Prince?
Yeah. Nope. Well, I'm going to throw out a couple of titles. See if you remember. Well, obviously Space Invaders, Pac-Man. Okay. Do you remember Lunar Lander?
Nope.
Which was a great, you got to land a lunar module. How about Battle Zone, which is a great tank game? No. Star Castles, which was in the movie. Great game. Zaxxon. Any of these familiar?
Nope.
Star Wars, I remember. Killer Shark.
Nope.
In which a shark came at you and you had a spear gun and you had to shoot it. No. How about Tron? Tron, I remember when that hit, because there were three different games at least. And when Tron hit, Defender.
Nope.
Pole Position. Knight Driver. Spy Hunter. Paperboy.
No, I don't play games.
Galaga? Like
I probably still won't want
to. How about you, Phil?
Ending on Galaga, Adam Sandler said Galaga was one of his favorite games of all time. But, fun movie? I enjoyed this movie. I'm probably going to buy it when it comes out on DVD.
Yeah, it was fun.
Despite what everyone has to say. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Yeah. You can follow us on iTunes and YouTube. Not AfterBuzz, that's our sister network.
Popcorn Talk
Network, Anatomy of a Movie, on Twitter, at Movie Anatomy. Dimitri, where can everyone follow you?
At DMovies1701.
And Phil, where can they follow you?
Here at the Popcorn Talk and Movie Anatomy, and on other movies.
Yeah, and you can follow me at Serafini TV. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will see you for our next dissection.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.